particularly to our visitors who have several people who have not been here for a seminar before. I'm Frank Clooney, the academic director, and glad that we're here today. I'll do a little publicity before we turn to today's event. This is a very busy week for the center. At 5 o'clock today, we have a lecture by Dr. Julius Lipner from Cambridge University on defining Hinduism. So what are we even doing when we're talking about the word? That's in the Oriental Institute at 5. You're free to be next on the presentation. Tomorrow in this room, we have a joint seminar with the Jewish Center on translation and proof. Again, Dr. Lipner and also Dr. Norman Sauer from the Jewish Center. And then tomorrow at 5, we have a lecture on the Center of Christianity and Culture on the history of kind of the interaction of Christianity and Hinduism by Dr. Michael Barnes from the College of Law. So all of these events are open. Love that people come, and we're happy if you can spare any more time for these events. But turning to the most important event, the event before us at the moment, we have a very distinguished scholar, Neelima Chitkopekar from New Delhi, who is with us for the term. She is a historian. She is a professor at Jesus and Mary College in New Delhi, which I was happy to visit this past summer, and it's clearly one of the number one colleges in New Delhi, so a very distinguished college to teach at. I think you're also chair of the history faculty at the college. Neelima did her dissertation work on sort of the history and early development of Shaivism that became a book called Encountering Shivaism, the Deity, the Milieu, and the Entourage, published in 1998. And she lectures on related subjects all the time. But she's also branched out. Her book that came out, the edited volume in 2002, Goddesses, Gender, Politics, and Religion. And then recently a monograph that's advertised, you can check on the way out here, the Book of Durga. Penguin book that's selling very well and that advertised very well and is very attractively done. And is working on a book on Shiva, which I think brings us to the topic of today's conversation, Devised Lineages and Client Biographies, a Study of Shiva and His Retinue.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you, Frank. Sure. Thank you. Okay. Well, it's called, the topic is... The title is Devised Lineages and Client Biographies, A Case Study of Shiva and His Retinue. I'll try and speak for about an hour, and then I'll have some questions and show the slides. Well, the unknowability of the divine is a powerful theme in Hindu tradition, but this has not deterred the wise and sometimes unwise over the millennia to try their luck and sometimes to try our patience. And so I won't talk too long today. We'll have enough interaction. I won't talk too much about Shiva because what I am doing is actually something I've just started, and I'm still in the earliest stages, but still. Today I hope to share with you briefly an attempt to give Shiva a lineage and a biography, a bit of a reckless undertaking since we all know that he has no lineage, for he is the original parent, Aja, the unborn one. So I mean lineage not in its most basic dictionary sense as an ancestry or pedigree, but to talk of the lineage of thought, of associations that are connected to Shiva to this day, that is the ideological dimensions of possible likely origins of some of the traits that help him be the oldest god in not just in India, but maybe some historians say even in the entire world, the oldest representation of godhead. My overarching frame of reference is that of a historian, though at the same time I am activated and actuated by the conviction that at least to a certain extent, it is always useful to have an interdisciplinary approach. The fear of intellectual isolation has found eloquent expression in Sanskrit text, in the worrying image of a kupamundak, that is a self-satisfied but secluded frog living in a well. This image is repeatedly invoked as a kind of intellectual warning from the millennium before Christ. The kupa's reach of philosophy is based, these texts warn, on a worldview entirely confined to the well, with suspicion about everything outside it. And as I go along my personal journey of searching for Shiva, I hope that I will never end up being one of those kupas. Kupamundaks. I have definitely benefited by work in anthropology, art, theology, philosophy, to name just a few. And I have found in their work intersections and overlaps with history, like as Professor Clooney has put it quite nicely, as long as the different disciplines prize the cultivation of insight and the achievement of wisdom, they should be considered. I also consider it important right now at the outset to state what I'm doing at this point of time. Why am I presenting this kind of paper? I'm writing a book entitled The Biography of Shiva. It's a commissioned piece of writing, which means I was asked by the publishers, which is Penguin, to write this book. They wanted me to put a book together dealing with the myriad aspects of Shiva. But this time, and I've already done a book on Shiva, which I have here with me, that they said this time don't write it for just the academics, which is a very small minority. Write it for everybody and bring in all the viewpoints that you have about Shiva, which you've talked about here, but in a more accessible form. So accessibility meant they want it partly fictionalized, much to my horror. So I am going to be talking about gods and goddesses and making a, kind of like a story out of them and trying to put across what I consider complex issues, which scholars have done vaad vivad over for the longest time, and they discuss it all the time in their conferences and places like this and in journals, but try to communicate the complexities, the paradoxes, the complications of Hindu deities, so that people, when you talk to them, you ask worshippers about Shiva, or you ask anyone about Shiva, for instance, they'll say, oh, he has so many representations because that is Maya and that is his Leela, etc., and not really understanding why did so many representations of Shiva come about. So I want to give a sense of a very fundamental and moot point of Indian civilization. That is the ever-continuing dynamism of the gods. At the risk of reification and essentializing, if I were allowed one categoric statement about Hinduism, throughout the Indian history, we find that it has a remarkably elastic nature. Instead of gloating over this elasticity, I think we need to explain it. It's so easy to say it's such a tolerant religion, but we have to explain why is it so, what was the reason behind it. The perhaps apocryphal figure, 330 million gods and goddesses in India, has become somewhat of a cliché. But what is amazing is that even these deities have undergone reduction by a regular process of sieving and winnowing. I mean, believe it or not, from time to time, those 330 million have been reduced and become smaller. As we all know, it is incorrect to think that all that was part of Hinduism has its origins in the Vedic literature. There may have been other texts that may not have survived, whose elements may have influenced the writings of the Brahmin poets. Nevertheless, it is the earliest solid reference we get in a literary text. Looking at the deities mentioned here and comparing them to a later period, such as the epics or the Purans, which embodies more of a current form of Hinduism, it seems that many deities did not survive the vagaries of time, nor the loyalties and predilections of fickle worshippers. In the realm of the family of gods, one can perhaps, I mean, we can't always talk about it in the field of human beings, but we can perhaps talk about the application of the Darwinian principle, survival of the fittest. It seems that only those gods survive who show signs or have the propensity, the applicability, and are able to adjust over a period of time. Those that are too sharply delineated, those who are distinctly phenomenal in nature, didn't really survive into the Puranic literature and have faded and disappeared and don't have a major role to play. Those that have survived were those which were able to make a dynamic shift in their nature, such as Vishnu and Shiva. And there are many ways that they survived. We should keep in mind, then, that although Hinduism appears to be a process of deliberate continuity, in fact, it is a continual selection of desired elements, often arising out of contemporary concerns and defined by existing social relations. So the first thing is that they had to have applicability. The second reason why gods have survived is because this whole process, which has now recently been called Puranic process, we've done away with great tradition, little tradition, but heuristically, I think they're still very useful to try and explain the whole process of how gods have how gods' characteristics have increased and why there are millions and millions of myths about one particular concept. And why there are so many different hands on a particular icon. I mean, this is one way of explaining it, that when new areas, and when I'm saying new, I'm meaning for Brahminical areas, are being increased on a political level, in a regional level, through land grants, when new areas are being brought within the Brahminical fold, within the Aryan fold, those areas were not devoid of gods, were not devoid of worship, or not devoid of people. Socially, they were brought into the Varnashram Dham mainly as, I would think they would be brought as the lowest caste, or they would have been given some kind of position in the social area. Socially, we are not as tolerant as we are where our gods are concerned. But their gods have been accommodated either as an avatar or as a representation of one of the major deities. And they've always been given a role, a place. It's not like they've been discarded. They've been given some kind of position within the Brahminical fold. And this is a process that we find throughout the centuries, especially when new areas like Odisha, Madhya Pradesh are being brought into the fold of the Brahminical fold. And erstwhile tribal gods are given a respectable position within Hinduism. This, it's a whole process called, we call it Puranic process now. We should keep in mind that, the new deities get formed by traits of other gods, or they are conjoined with deities by the growth of a family system or avatars, thereby making it more organic and whole. We find that Vishnu's popularity increased as he brought in different deities within his own fold as avatars. It's not just we know about the 10 avatars, but if you look at some of the other Purans, sometimes we hear that he has 27 Purans, mm-hmm. others we hear he has 28, 32 avatars. The totems of different tribes perhaps were brought in. Shiva worked more with a family system, and he brought in a very powerful goddess as his wife. He was spousified, he was consortified with Parvati. And it's interesting to see how nothing was smooth. They get together, but there's so much of tension in the mythology and in the sculpture. So many attempts to syncretize them, so many attempts to make composite images, which perhaps reflects this kind of entity. Anyway. It is difficult to trace the evolution of a process of interaction between various social groups spread over several centuries, particularly when the cultural matrix that governed the relationship of reciprocity and domination is not always sharply defined, and the primary evidence is limited to a single category of texts with an obvious bias. So I have to look at Brahminical texts whether I like it or not. There are not that many other sources to look at this process. But one can follow the logic of cultural negotiation implicit in the Puranic records, and on that basic construct, we can construct a discernible pattern of the manner in which negotiations were conducted. And all the time, Brahminical social order and Brahminical superiority was always maintained through this whole thing. And that is why there's such a smooth moving between tribal, cultural, metaphysical. You have the most abstruse and difficult philosophy at one end. Then you have a very totemistic kind of worship at the other end. They all can exist side by side. There's a fluidity between all the different levels with all of them, because all the different people came together. Nothing was discarded. There was no inquisition. People were allowed to worship their gods and have their own rituals. There has been the presence of the other who need to be accommodated or defined. So we hear about the denigrated Panis, Dasyus of the Rig Veda, the Kirats, Pulindas, Shabaras, Vratyas of the later Vedic period. There's a constant sense of people living on the periphery of the Brahminical fold. But what I am interested in is the process, the modus operandi. Many deities that we view as orthodox or Brahminical today, to begin with, when we encountered, are steeped in opprobrium. So when we look at Shiva or we look at Vishnu to begin with, they have a very small position, and they are deities who are feared. And so I'll just take up Shiva real quickly in the Rig Veda, since that is our earliest text. And we find that there's just about three hymns. Most of you must be knowing that. There are just about three hymns which are dedicated to Shiva in the Rig Veda. And he's mentioned about 75 times. And you can only see this if you contrast it with the other deities like Indra or Varun. And they have been mentioned like hundreds of times, and they have separate hymns to them. And you would think that all the time today in India, we keep saying, go back to the Vedas, go back to the Vedas. But if you go back to the Vedas, you have deities who we are not worshipping right now. It's Shiva, and Shiva is not even called Shiva. Shiva is called Rudra, and he has totally different characteristics. Historians have tried to deal with this. They don't know how to explain this necessarily, but they say that if there was an evolutionary mythology, and over a period of time, myths kept getting added on to these deities and made them more popular, like accumulating them. Rudra Shiva, I think, more than anything else, he was, of course, made popular by getting a wife like Parvati and by getting a son like Ganesh, who were two very popular deities. And at the same time, it seems he gets Brahmanized because he has two important thoughts, two important ideas that get associated with him. One is asceticism and the other is phallicism. And I feel a little sorry for him because it's like he's been made the scapegoat, and he doesn't appear to be a phallic god at all in the Rig Veda, but suddenly he's important for his phallus. It is clear that the Shiva of the Sanskrit text is not the exclusive successor of Rudra. Shiva is encountered in different regions. So we find him in Maharashtra, he's called Khandoba, in Karnataka, Mailara, in Andhra Pradesh, Malana, and they're all brought together. So we find that in the Purans, the Shiva that is represented there is all the different regional ideas which come together and coagulate there. In the Rig Veda, we find that Shiva is the ultimate persona non grata. His anger is legion, even though he also cures diseases. So he is very wrathful. He is an angry god, but he is also the one who heals. And I found, interestingly enough, that when I looked at inscriptions from the 7th century onwards in places like Madhya Pradesh, I find that his physician or his Vaidyanath roop is important there. So they do seem to pick up certain ideas that are current in the Rig Veda even later on. So he is a healer. He is associated with herbs and things like that. But I just want to read out one particular passage which shows the beseeching nature, which I found a little funny. Usually all the Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Atharva Veda, they have all these passages where Shiva is being implored not to harm them. But this is one particularly intense one. It said, discharge not your arrow even after it has been laid on the bow and has been drawn. Destroy not our bipeds and our quadrupeds. This has been said for many deities. Prepare not our bodies for the dog or the jackal, for the vultures and the blackbirds, the greedy insects. Let the birds not devour us. We offer reverence to the east, north, south, every domain in the heaven, reverence to thy atmosphere. To thy face, to thy skin, to thy form, to thy appearance, to thy limbs, to thy belly, to thy tongue, to thy teeth, to thy smell, reverence be to you. Far from us shall go the jackals, evil omens, dogs. Far shall go mourning women who bewail misfortune with disheveled hair. Reverence to the coming, reverence to the going, reverence to the standing, reverence to the sitting, etc., etc. So it's just this kind of idea with Shiva, that he's the wrathful one. He has to be feared. They have to be beseeching. They have to implore him not to harm, and this is the way he is. And sometimes we hear that he's also the deity of balmy medicines and herbs, etc. Then how is it that this deity, who is associated with the bow and arrow, who is a hunter, who is seen attacking the cattle and attacking people and causing illnesses and disease, how does he get associated with asceticism? The two important aspects, like that he is an ascetic. That's how, if you ask any Hindu today, they would say, yes, Shiva is Mahayogi, he's the ultimate yogi. How did that happen, and how did he get associated with phallicism? We don't see any sign of that in the earliest texts. So it is fascinating to look into the rich traditions of heterodoxy that have been so central in the history of Hindu culture. The existence of parallel religious forms, some conflicting and others cohering, had characterized Indian society. Some of these distanced themselves from all orthodoxies and attracted those who participated in what might be called forms of countercultures, and others preferring the openness of the heterodox. Their ancestry can perhaps be traced through a lineage of thought and behavior going back to the wandering Vratyas, Keshans, and the mendicants of the Upanishads. We feel that Shaivism today, when we study Shaivism, it was perhaps the oldest monastic organization. The earliest ascetics belonged to them, the Pashupatas. We hear about in the Mahabharata. We don't hear about them earlier. Shiva seems to have, in his personality and in his character, attracted asceticism. And even though he attracted asceticism, it was a kind of asceticism that gets connected somewhere with phallicism. So the asceticism is also one, it is renunciation, but very disturbing and makes many people very uneasy about what kind of asceticism is this when you are also so obviously associated with phallicism, which appears to be erotic. So how does this happen? And I think because this association is there and people don't understand it so much, the myths that followed always showed Shiva running away from marriage, running away from Parvati, going into the mountainside, wanting to do penance, and constantly saying that I am the ascetic and I don't need a son, I don't need a child, I don't need someone for my Shraddha ceremony. So why should I cohabit with you? And then there's Parvati who wants to cohabit with him and wants to have a son. And so there's all these myths that come up in the Purans which also bespeak of this kind of tension between the two. But before that, I just want to, this is a very well-known sukta which I'm going to read out, but it tells us about the kind of asceticism that Shiva gets associated with. And I think it's a very beautiful, very well-written. It sort of like epitomizes the kind of Shaivic ascetics that I have come across. It sort of like epitomizes them. It's called the Keshi Sukta. I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. He with the long hair holds the fire. He holds the drink. He holds heaven and earth. He with the long hair is declared to be this light. These sages clothed by the wind wear dirty tatters. Following the rush of the wind, they go where the gods have gone before. Exhilarated by asceticism, we have risen into the winds. Our physical bodies are all you mortals can see. He flies through the air, seeing all the various forms below. The sage has made himself a friend and associate to every god. The stallion of the wind, the friend of the wind, and urged onward by the gods. The sage is at home in both the eastern and the western seas. He moves like the heavenly spirits, like the beast of the forest. He with the long hair reading their minds is a sweet and most delightful companion. The wind has churned his drink. Kunanama has prepared it for him. He with the long hair drinks from the cup, sharing it with Rudra. Already you find they're drinking the cup. The word that is used for the drink is vish. Perhaps it's one of the hallucinogens which are associated with Shiva. And Kunanama is, whatever text I've read, they have associated her with the tantric goddess Kubjika, the crooked body one, who helps prepare, she grinds the hallucinogen for the drink. Now, it is already quite clear that Indian asceticism is not a mournful gospel of sorrow or a painful mortification of the flesh in morbid penance, but a noble effort towards a higher joy and an absolute possession of the spirit, a great joy of self-conquest, a still joy of inner peace, and the forceful joy of a supreme self-exceeding is at the heart of its experience. So it's a different kind of asceticism that we see here from the others. And this is usually taken as the prototype of ascetics, Shaiva ascetics, the Keshi Sukta. Now, can we say that this was a clan of Rudra worshippers, since Rudra's name is mentioned there? When we look at Sayan and we look at what he has to say, he says that this Sukta really refers to the sun god Surya with his spreading rays, long hair, absorbing the water's vish. And after reading how the beauty of that passage, I just didn't agree with that at all, and so I don't know what he's trying to say. How did the sun god come in, and the hair is being compared to the spreading rays? But anyway, still the ascetic is a very minor religious type in this period. It's only later on, the Upanishads attest to the existence of ascetic traditions by the 6th, 5th centuries, traditions of asceticism and world renunciation. They were looked down upon by the Brahmins. The Brahmins were of the Rig Veda and other Vedic literature were mainly concerned with material prosperity, children, cattle, not necessarily associated with asceticism. Associated with asceticism is tapas. And I just want to very, very briefly just talk about that. And I know all of you already know how at a particular point of time, gods, demons, children, animals, goddesses, celibate youths, everybody was performing tapas. And tapas is, God Brahma produces tapas, Shiva produces tapas. And we hear Parvati maintains tapas for 36,000 years. And demons all over were doing tapas and getting all kinds of powers that they shouldn't have had. And this is very closely associated with asceticism. And I'm saying this because we're coming close to towards phallicism and the worship of the phallus. Tapas used to be seen as a psychophysical energy, perhaps, the accumulation of which determines one's position in the universe. The aim was, therefore, to reach a higher position with greater power through tapas. In the Hindu yoga tradition, celibacy is part and parcel of an elaborate technology of self-realization that links abstinence with a carefully mapped out science of energy. Hindu tradition is full of tales of renouncers building up a large store of tapas over many years by lives of single-minded and sometimes spectacular austerity. Tapas is likened to a physical substance that which increases by accumulation. Classically, it is expended by anger or sexual activity. The tradition abounds in stories of awesome ascetics being seduced by nubile asuras with a resulting loss of their powers. Now, Shiva acquires this inner heat, which is known as tapas, and then that's where we come to phallicism. And it's necessary for him to acquire this kind of tapas. Therefore, the phallus is shown in its ithyphallic stage. I still find people making a lot of fun of the whole ithyphallicism that is shown in the Urdhra Linga, not really trying to understand it, but we'll come to it in a moment. There is both textual and archaeological evidence to prove that the phallus cult was of independent origin without any connection with Rudra in its earlier stages. He was not ithyphallic. Why should it have been assimilated with him then? There is not a single trait in the character of Rudra in the Rig Veda or later Vedic literature which would even remotely suggest that it was any part of his function to grant offspring, which is what we obviously, very overtly, we connect that to phallicism. What were the compulsions that by the time of the epics it became an integral part of Shivaism? Maybe just after modifying it a little bit. The old cult of the Rudra appears in the Mahabharata with the extraneous phallus cult grafted onto it, and the mighty Vedic god who had been feared by the gods and men reappears as a deity who is granting offspring, who is delighting in dancing, singing, etc. There's one interesting passage in the 14th chapter of the Anushasan Parva of Mahabharata where there's a clear reference to Shiva's linga worship. Upamanyu, while recounting the glories of Shiva before Krishna, says, Mahadev was the only god whose organ of generation, that is the linga, is worshipped by men. The sage further observes that Brahma, Vishnu, all the other gods always worship his linga as the highest. And then he goes on to say, and I found this quite interesting, no human being bears the mark of a lotus, a discus, or a thunderbolt on their body. But all beings of all beings bear the mark of Maheshwar. They have the marks of either the male or the female organ of generation on their body. And so this is a direct, this is also a direct indication that the ling was worshipped with the Argya, the ling was worshipped with the Yoni at that time itself. So this is, thunderbolt, the emblems of the different deities are not found on the body, but the ling and Yoni is found on every male and female. There is no clear literary evidence to prove the existence of this ritual practice among worshippers of Shiva before the centuries of the Common Era. So this would be, I would think, a little later, perhaps the Mahabharata evidence. Parts of the body may take on a symbolic meaning, thus the erect phallus turns into a symbol when its meanings go beyond the directly biological and when the roles it plays mainly serve goals other than passion and procreation. The phallus and its symbolic... Another one from the Shweta Shaptar Upanishad. I'm not completely sure whether they were trying to mean this, but this is what, you know, most of the historians have taken up, that Ishan, that is Shiva, presides over every yoni and over all forms of yonis. And this is taken from the Upanishad, and perhaps its meaning, it could mean directly that this ling and this yoni are joined together, or it could mean that it's just he presides over the womb, or he presides over creation, or it could mean that as well. In the Purans, by the time we come to the Purans, there are several episodes of what are called Lingodbhav or Linga Virbhav, where we find the Ling appears, and it's almost like they're trying to give a justification to phallic worship, phallus worship or phallic worship. And the stories are quite interesting there. You find them in Brahman Puran, the Shiva Puran, Kurma Puran. It's almost like they're trying to give a raison d'etre as to why we have to worship the Ling. And though historians over the years, some of them have been uncomfortable with saying that it's a phallus, they try to say it's not a phallus, though he does very phallic things with his phallus. They try to say it's the tree, it's the skamba, it's the pillar, but it's not the phallus. And Shiva goes into the pinewood forest, and in each Puran has a slight variation. And he goes into the forest one time because he's so unhappy because Sati is dead. And so he's roaming around naked, and he's got all the, his body is smeared with ashes. And he goes into the forest where the ascetics' wives are doing all kinds of things. And there's these wonderful stories, which actually you hear about in connection with Krishna also, that whatever they were doing, they just leave it midway. So these wonderful descriptions of how some of them haven't got their clothes on properly. One has kajal only in one eye, and she ran out like that. One has not done her tresses properly. And they see him, and they're so taken in by his beauty, and it's very obviously his phallic beauty, and they've described that. And there's in such a state of arousal, they come running out. And the ascetics are so unhappy about that. Now, one thing is that you can just look at it as, okay, there's this wonderful man who's come in and these women are attracted to him. But in another Puran, they'll say, oh, they didn't like their form of worship, and Shiva was trying to put forward a new form of worship, which was worship through the Pashupati way, Pashupat mark, rather than the Vedic way. So that's also brought in. So there, perhaps this shows us some kind of cultic tension going on between the two different ways of approaching salvation. We also find that through the Lingodbhav, there is a definite signs of rivalry between Vishnuism and Shivaism, because there's the other one in which Vishnu and Brahma are arguing that they both are greater than each other. And Shiva, tired of the two of them quarreling like goats, we're told. And this is always in the Shaivic Purans, because Vaishnava Purans would never say that. That Brahma and Vishnu are both goats and they're quarreling. And so Shiva appears as the flaming pillar of fire. Now, he's not a phallus. Now, that's the one I'm talking about, where he's not exactly the ling. He's not exactly the phallus. A flaming pillar of fire, and one goes on the top to see where does it start, and one goes at the bottom, and then they give a reason why Brahma is not worshipped, because he tells a lie. He says, I saw the beginning, and he actually didn't see the beginning. So Brahma doesn't have any temples. They justify that and say he does. I mean, they give a reason for that he doesn't have any temples because he lied. And eventually Shiva emerges from the ling. And that's actually what usually happens. Shiva emerges from the ling, except for the one that I told you before that. He is so angry at the sages for cursing him that there's a self-castration taking place. He plucks off his ling and he puts it down on the ground. And the whole world, there's chaos everywhere. There's pell-mell because he doesn't have his ling. He's the greatest god. So then he goes into hiding, and then they go looking for him, and they go and ask Brahma, what do we do? He says he's the greatest god. His ling has to be placed in the yoni, and only when the ling and yoni are put together, then there will be the chaos in the world will stop. When they go to him and tell him, please take your ling back, he says, what need do I have of a ling? I'm not a married man. My wife has died. So, you know, then you know that it's more phallic, and that you're going down to looking at it as just as the male sex organ rather than anything else. And so I think the ling, when they try to explain it, they are constantly trying to give it a reason. In most of the Purans, whether it's Ling Puran, Shaiv Puran, Brahman Puran, they are trying to explain why Shiva's ling has to be worshipped. I think there is still a discomfort with this whole idea of ling, the ling cult, and ling worshippers were still looked down upon somewhat, even in the time of the Purans. Okay. Just very briefly, this whole idea of the ling, I mean, I don't think I need to go into too much detail, but I think most of you know that the idea that semen contains a vital force it's common to Chinese, Indian, and Greek traditions. For the Chinese, it's the vital essence, that is qi, is to be spared and increased. In the Indian tradition, it's the fire of asceticism, that's tapas, which produces supernatural powers, that is siddhi. In Greek medicine, sperm contains spirit, that is pneuma, a substance whose loss would diminish the vitality of the whole organism. On the contrary, the accumulation... Okay, I won't go into that much detail right now. Finally, the part that I'd like to just mention briefly. Shiva then, as if this was not enough for him, that he was a deity who was a hunter and he was, you know, doing what he wanted to in the Rig Veda, and then he becomes the god of the phallus, and then he goes and gets married to Parvati. And there again, there are problems because we hear, like in the Bhagavad Puran, the whole episode of Daksha, the whole episode of in the Bhagavad Puran, in the Ling Puran, in the Shiva Puran, the different versions that are given of Daksha where he's not invited for the sacrifice. And again, it's there are signs of cultic tension between the two different forms, between Daksha and Shiva. Daksha is a deity who obviously was a Vaishnav follower and didn't like Shiva. And he says a lot of pretty nasty things to him, considering that he was his son-in-law. But he says, and here I'd just like to mention this, what he says in the Bhagavad Puran about Shiva, because Shiva didn't stand up when he entered the sacrificial area. Didn't stand up to Daksha. So he says, what is his lineage and what is his clan? What place does he belong to and what is his nature? What does he do for a living? How does he behave? He drinks poison and rides a bull. Not an ascetic, for how can one who carries a weapon be an ascetic? He is not a householder. He lives in the cremation ground. He's not even celibate. He has a wife. So this sort of like epitomizes all the problems that people must have been having, because myths are, after all, you know, reflections of kind of problems people are thinking about. How do you think of Shiva as a deity? I mean, he has all these... Can you call him an ascetic? Can you call him a householder? What can you call him? I still have a little bit of time. I want more feedback from you all as to how I will be able to reconcile phallicism with asceticism. Of course, it's a known fact. Yesterday, when we were at Professor Sanderson's class, he brought it up as well. It's a well-known fact that when you look at ithyphallicism and you look at Urdhvaling or you look at Urdhvamed, It's a clear indication in Indian thinking and in Hindu thought, not Indian thinking, in Hindu thought, that the unshed seed would be raised. Because it's an unshed seed, it's the raised lingam. And therefore, you can look at the erect phallus as asceticism, the extreme form of asceticism. But I don't know how far I'll be able to take that, and how far I would be able to do it with just these few examples that I have at my disposal. I have written about it extensively here because I just had to quote one Puran after the other. But when I'm writing for everybody, I'm not completely sure whether I'll be able to deal with something as complex as that, and whether I'd be able to put together asceticism, phallicism, and try and explain Shiva in this manner. So I think I'll stop here, and I'd like some questions. And I think after the questions, I prefer to show you the slides, or do you want to see them right now? I would like some remarks on what I just said.
scholars that have worked in the field and
yeah.
tried to explain Shiva
yeah.
in different
yeah.
ways.
O'Flaherty. I think she's Doniger now. She
yeah.
keeps changing her husbands. But anyway, Doniger, she and Cranbridge, both of them being phenomenologists, they've not really looked at the history. They've not talked, in fact, they've not talked about the history at all. So they're not, I am interested in seeing where are the names non-Sanskritic? Where does Shiva get a non-Sanskritic epithet, for instance? And does that mean that a new set of people are becoming followers of Shiva then? And I go through inscriptions in detail to see which areas are being Brahmanized and Aryanized. And so which gods are being... And what is being mentioned in the inscriptions? What is the name like this? One I read somewhere, Gahunda. The name of Shiva is Gahunda. When we looked it up in the dictionary, it means dog. But that is an epithet of Shiva in one of the far-flung areas of Madhya Pradesh. So, and similarly, we have a name, Vankeshwar. And again, Vankeshwar, probably the Prakrit form. And I'll be showing you the slide. He looks so different from the way Shiva is supposed to be depicted, that is, Sinhakati, lion-waisted, slim, very beautiful man. And here we have Vankeshwar, who comes from what we know was tribalized for the longest time, because we have inscriptional evidence for that. Vankeshwar is really huge and just looks like one of those tribal deities who should have been, I'm saying tribal without being judgmental, just as a device once again, he should have been probably made out of terracotta. You can't imagine it's made out of stone. So I think I would look, I would try and map. It won't be easy, but I would not just look at the Purans without trying to look at other sources and other, you know, the context, the historical context.
Yes, you don't feel there's a difficulty with trying to interpret that kind of material, which is ahistorical, anti-historical. It's
yeah.
a problem, whereas they don't have that problem if you're
yeah.
looking at it purely from a
yeah.
mythological or artistic point of view.
Yeah.
You can interpret it symbolically
yeah.
or in terms of myth, it gives you a lot of
yeah.
scope
yeah. You're
and brain. It
but
gives
it's
you a lot of flexibility. Whereas if you're doing it historically, you're
yeah.
tied to
yeah.
evidence, facts.
Yeah. But you know, I'm a historian.
Yes.
And we sort of like think that we'll be able to
mm-hmm.
pull things together. And perhaps it sounds a little far-fetched at times, but this is the way we would do it. I would try and retrace, I would try to trace and put it in a diachronic, synchronic kind of paradigm.
Yeah.
That's what I would try and do. Yes, Madhavan?
A comment. Coming back to the point that you were making about phallicism and the tension between the phallicism and marriage, I found... working with images,
mm-hmm.
that the images of Shiva, where he is associated with his consort, are late. So we don't have any images of him associated directly with Parvati before around the 3rd century
yeah.
after Christ.
Yeah.
The earliest representation is the one on Kushan coins,
yeah.
but that is an association between Vaishya
mm-hmm.
and Uma.
Yes. Yeah.
So maybe they're completely different
yeah.
people.
We
so
don't know that yet. You're going to write
yeah.
about that. You're going to let us know.
So
yeah.
that is definitely on a Kushan Kanishka coin,
yeah.
but they have not yet been associated with Shiva and Parvati.
Mm-hmm.
And the conjoined, I mean, the images where they are shown as a loving couple,
mm-hmm.
they all happen later.
Yes.
While all the important phallic images, or even the images of him in anthropomorphic form,
mm-hmm.
are ithyphallic.
Mm-hmm.
They always show him as ithyphallic,
mm-hmm.
very much in the ascetic mode.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, I don't know if one can make a conclusion from
okay.
this, but certainly where the extant material is concerned, the phallic symbol is the most important symbol.
Mm-hmm.
It is the phallus that we find in profusion from around the 2nd, 1st century BC onwards. We then find his ithyphallic images, particularly in the Gandharan region.
Mm-hmm.
And the images of him with his consort start to appear from around Rajasthan
mm-hmm.
and central India
mm-hmm.
from 3rd century onwards,
mm-hmm.
3rd is like
yeah.
the earliest.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it seems as though that
yeah.
Association happens later.
Later, yeah. Okay.
As the goddess card probably becomes
yeah,
more important.
That's right, that's right. And interestingly, whenever he's shown with his consort, we have Uma Maheshwar Murthy or we have
yeah,
Shiva Parvati.
All late.
And not only are they late, but he's never shown Ithi Phallic. That's
yeah.
interesting that they're, he's
in
quite
the,
calm by then.
In the early 3rd, 4th century images, he still has the Ithiphallicism.
But
yeah,
he's shown with her.
Her.
Oh,
with
I see,
her.
I haven't seen
but,
those. Okay.
That is the early type, but there are lots of things that are not typical of
yeah.
these images in these early images,
yeah.
which then get taken away
yeah.
and
yeah.
formalized later.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Excuse my ignorance, but on your chart you have, what is it, priapism?
Yeah, priapism. Priapism is a state of arousal which is not connected with asceticism, but it's just an erotic arousal. And so very often it is asked, you know, how far is, when you see this deity as Ithi Phallic, how far is it priapic? How far is he priapic? The ritual, incidentally, is not really priapic. It has nothing to do with the fact that, and it doesn't look like that. That's why I have the earliest Gudimalam Ling, which is just the most realistic form of the phallus. And that's how I believe quite a few of them were made at a particular point of time. Then the discomfort with the ling perhaps reached its height at the time of the Gupta period, which must be circa 4th, 5th century CE. And we find that the ling, which looked very much like a male sex organ, becomes completely stylized. So it's got a rounded top and it's made more acceptable. And not only that, they cover it. You have the Chaturmukh ling and you have the Panchamukh ling, so you have all these faces on the ling. Perhaps not let it... they're uneasy with showing what it actually represented. So priapism is an erotic kind of arousal.
It's also an illness.
Pardon?
It's a form of illness.
Is it really? Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Now in the medicine...
It is... Oh, okay.
It's only an illness.
Okay, yeah. Unnatural state, no doubt.
Might want to see the whole development of Tantra that comes later.
Yeah. I'm not too sure because Tantra, there's a lot of emphasis on the goddess, and it's not really the male. It's the male is supposed to, in fact, be Shav-like. He's supposed to be quiescent and very. It's the goddess who arouses. I think it's more emphasis on the goddess in the Tantra. I mean, this has been a tendency. There has been a tendency that anything that appears to be sexual in nature is put within Tantra, and so you even have the Ashwamedh. People say, "Oh, the Ashwamedh in the Rig Vedic period," because the chief queen is supposed to cohabit with the horse, the dead horse, so therefore that's tantric. But Tantra is itself has its own nuances and is very different from many of these things. I'm not too sure. I'm not aware. No. Yeah.
Sorry, Nina. I remember that the word Virya inserted means both sperm
mm-hmm.
and the power of the asceticism.
Yeah.
So asceticism and sex can go side by side because this word is a sort of bridge between
yeah, okay.
the two
yeah.
meaning.
Yeah.
And if we remember the story of the marriage between Parvati and Shiva,
yeah.
Told in Kumarasambhava,
yeah.
in the 8th canto, you know that... Parvati, in order to seduce
mm-hmm.
Shiva, cannot use sex and
mm-hmm.
beauty as own because he was completely full of asceticism, full of tapas.
Mm-hmm.
So he seduced him in making, in her turn,
mm-hmm.
tapas.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That is Virya.
Mm-hmm.
In this meaning, maybe Parvati won Virya by Virya.
Yes, okay.
And
yes, she did.
Versa.
Yeah. Well, yes, that's a good point. What I found about in the Purans where Parvati is concerned, she goes into do tapas very often, but she does it also because he calls her Kali and he calls her black skinned, and so she goes and runs and does tapas because she
yes,
wants to seduce him and become fair skinned.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason that she
yes.
does tapas. But yes, you're right.
It's interesting because you remember in the name of Parvati is also Uma.
Yes,
but as a popular etymology is
yes.
Don't make it.
Yeah, Uma.
Uma.
Yes, exactly, Uma.
So
yeah.
we can ask ourselves.
Yeah.
what Parvati doesn't not make sex or a shredishes.
Yeah. Okay.
When Parvati Mother said to her, don't make it what?
Okay, what don't make? Okay.
We have two possibilities. No?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You're making a comment, or you're asking me?
You ask, of course. Yeah, I'm a pupil, not a teacher. Now,
yeah, I'll take Krista's question, and then I'll see if I can answer yours.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think this question of how to reconcile the asceticism and what we're calling phallicism is partially just an issue that we have looking at it from a westernized perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, I think from the original perspective, there wasn't any need to reconcile them because they're already seen as part of one spectrum, in a sense. I mean, it's clear that I think that Shiva is ithyphallic because he has done asceticism, and that, you know, the way in which creative energy, which is also sexual energy, is worked with and manipulated and regarded is on this whole spectrum of possibilities. So I have to agree about the idea of tantric ritual being a negotiation between the ways that this energy can be worked with on the whole range. And because in tantrism also we have celibate ascetics, we have householders, we have sexual activity in a highly ritualized setting, in a whole variety of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly, they were seeing things from the perspective of this energy is a force,
mm-hmm.
you know, that can be used to increase spiritual power. It can be used to gain so-called
Siddhis,
magical powers,
Siddhis.
Whatever you want to call them. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it can be expended and lost.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that the unifying principle then is that, you know, over and against the sort of Western vision of Shiva merely as destroyer, he's also clearly a deity of creative power.
But then still the discomfort is there in all the myths. Mm. They keep on talking, they criticize and they describe his phallus in detail and they make it sound so ugly. And they make him be such an ugly personality, horrific. Mm-hmm. And they try to reconcile with it, but you can also see. I mean, why are these myths there in the Purans? Were they themselves in the 10th century, or not even 10th? We can start with 5th century. From the 5th century onward, are already very uncomfortable. And when we had the Gudimalam Ling, which I think I should show the slides, why did they have to stylize it so much? So the discomfort was there with it. The uneasiness was there. It was so realistic to begin with. And why did it have to? And another thing about Gudimalam. Gudimalam does not have any argya. Gudimalam is not placed on the yoni. It became very convenient later for syncretic ideology. When you say, okay, here's the worship of the goddess. She's in the yoni. And the ling is on top. Gudimalam ling, the very first one which we have, it has no yoni.
Yeah, but yonis you don't have for a long time afterwards as well.
Yeah.
It takes a while for the yoni to attach to the ling.
Yeah. Very long time, actually.
Yeah, very long time, exactly.
Gupta period, I think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you start to have the way we date lings is by the fact that they are more real.
That's what I was saying, realistic.
In the early
period. Yeah.
And they become
exactly.
progressively stylized. But they start to have the faces.
Yeah.
By the Kushan period.
Yes.
So and by Chetan. Then they've become completely stylized.
That's right.
So it's a very early on that this process of trying to remove the realism from it and what it's linked to. But even in the pre-Kushan period, we have relief scenes showing ling worship.
Yeah.
By Ganata.
That's right, that's right. Actually, I forgot. I'm glad I brought up the questions always make me remember the Shishna Deva that I've mentioned here. This is the earliest mention in the Rig Veda. We have references to Indra destroying the homes, the castles or whatever, the big homes of Shishna Devas. And when you see the translation, Shishna Devas is those, one meaning is those who are phallic worshippers. And the second one is lascivious, lewd people who play with themselves. And so this is the earliest reference to the phallus in the Rig Veda. And so there are three hymns in which three times the Shishna Deva comes up. And so we definitely get the sense that the indigenous population, whatever we want to call them, they were worshippers of the phallus and the Shishna, and who Indra was destroying, because we hear about fortresses being destroyed, and we do know perhaps some of the Indus fortresses were still there, and that they were, he was destroying that, and there were people there worshipping the phallus. So we're not completely sure. Again, we have this, what is called, used to be called the prototype Pashupati, the earliest representation of Shiva, which today more popularly is called the horned deity, because we're not completely sure, is it Shiva, is it not Shiva? I mean, anything that is ithyphallic, that appears to be ithyphallic, is called Shiva. And since we haven't deciphered the script properly of the Indus civilization, we wouldn't completely be sure about that. Yeah. Yes, sir. Can I take it? Yeah.
Are there, just to clarify, because I'm in the, well, many of these things, are there ithyphallic images in the, amongst these Indus tablets?
Indus. No, there is. That's what I'll be showing you. There is one.
Uh-huh.
But we are not sure. Is it the phallus, or is it a belt? Is it a woman? Is it male? Is it a bull, a seated bull? Asko Parpola recently said it's a seated bull, and you have similar seals in the Elamite area, and you have, you know, this is from, I think, Scandinavia or somewhere. You have similar looking. He's not ithyphallic, though. That's a problem. I mean, people are trying to relate all these different images to that Shiva. But neither is he ithyphallic, neither is he properly seated in the yogic posture. But yes, horns seem to be there, and animals seem to be surrounding this image. So there's this... It's controversial. It's not something that people historians have agreed upon. So, and yet we have what could be a kind of board game pieces which look completely phallic. They're there in the National Museum. Lapis lazuli ones.
There's been some research on that more recently, and there is a lot of doubt about whether they were phallic at all or not. And the general consensus now is that they were
board pieces. They can be held.
They're
made in such a way that they can be held. These are lapis lazuli. Is that Honda? Honda.
No, this was done by Dales.
George Dales. Okay. That's interesting. But I didn't know that. Because they're made out of lapis lazuli. They're actually quite wonderful to look at. Okay.
They were board.
It's just like, you know, when you see the terracotta goddess figurines in the Indus civilization, and, you know, many people are questioning, can we call them goddesses? Are they their smoke stained? Was incense burnt in front of them? Do they look like Hindu goddesses? Or were they just household decorations? Who's to say before the script is deciphered properly? So you have something in India today, and you sort of like want to trace it back to 4000 BC or 3000 BC. The tendency is there, and the temptation is there. But, you know, as history students, we have to be careful about that. Yeah.
Well, I was glad you brought up the Puranic myth of the pine forest incident.
Yeah, Daruvan.
The linga drops off.
That's right.
Because that, I think, typically
the
dynamic tension you're talking about. Because on the one hand, these Brahmins are horrified by as one of my teachers said, God shows up and they don't recognize him.
Yes, they don't. He disguises himself deliberately also.
And that's a very telling symbolic trope by itself.
Yeah.
But just the fact that on the one hand, they are horrified and shocked and scandalized.
Yes.
But on the other hand, the story is clearly showing how losing his linga causes all
chaos,
these problems.
Yeah.
And clearly it represents a sacred power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so...
Yeah.
And I think it's not confusing that they were uncomfortable with it because it was so powerful. And if you look at a parallel in the South Indian tradition to how feminine power is regarded and how the goddess is portrayed there, like in this very important Tamil text, the Silapathi Haram, when the feminine power isn't properly
she takes off her
channeled, raises this entire city to the ground.
You're talking about when she cuts off her breast.
Yeah.
That's the one you're talking about. Okay.
Silapathikara. She wrenches it off and throws it, becomes a sort of grenade. And
That's right, yeah.
Full of mother. But I think but it's symbolic of the fact that
there's the missile and there's the grenade.
When it's properly channeled, just like sexual energy, it's incredibly beneficial.
That's
auspicious.
Right.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And when it's not properly channeled, it's considered to be destructive.
That's right.
So there's That's why they're uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's right. But yet the tale brings in the human propensities, that the sages are jealous that their wives are leaving everything. They're not looking after the elders. The pets are not being fed. All that is that they're angry that he's attracted all these wives. So that aspect, that I guess the human element is always there, the Purans. That's what makes them so interesting. Yeah.
Concerning actually the fact that Brahmin would be angered at the fact that this association of Phallicism and asceticism, I'm not quite certain about this. And we do have, I can quote it, but I remember reading that there is actually a whole aspect of looking at sexual activity within Brahminical circles, what's actually taken as an oblation.
I think his nudity bothered everyone at this point of time. It was the nudity of the god. That's what something that they talk about all the time, that he's nude, and then the fact that he's ash besmeared. We've been doing bhasma and how, bhasma comes up all the time. Cremation grounds, you pick up the bhasma. I still maintain that it was mainly taken from the cremation grounds. The fact that he's put bhasma on his body. And I don't know, maybe, I mean, if you could give me the quotation, tell me where it's from. I really don't know about it. Different kind. We were talking about how there were different kinds of ascetics. So the kind that the Pashupatas, Kalamukhas, Kapalikas, all the extreme forms of asceticism joined Shiva. And then there were the others, I think, perhaps, who would have joined the more milder forms of asceticism. That's what that's the feeling I get. I have to still do a lot of work on this. Yeah.
I'm curious about the connection between the Vedic Rudra and who we know as Shiva.
Yeah.
Because to me, when you read about Rudra in the Vedas, there's actually the only thing that seems to be connected is the name.
Yeah, the name is hyphenated. It's
later on
used.
So to me, it seems very much that the worshippers of Shiva, they have tried to lend him some kind of Vedic authority by saying that, you see, Rudra, he's mentioned here in the Veda.
Like they do with
Ganesh, they will say that.
Yeah, Gana is mentioned.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Shiva was a term that was used, since it means auspicious, it was used for many deities in the Rig Veda. And it was just used for him. It's probably what that word apotropaic, you're sort of like trying, you're fearing him and you're worshipping him, therefore, but you're calling him Shiva, Shiva, Shiva to sort of like take away the malignancy of the malignant nature of the deity by going on saying, you are auspicious, you are kind, whereas actually he wasn't. But he definitely, even now, the way he's depicted with tiger skin or deer skin, skirt. I mean, you go through Delhi, you go through any part in India, and when you see him as a statue or you see him as calendar art, he's always with his tiger skin. Very clearly, I mean, when I talk to my students about it, very clearly a god of the hunters and gatherers and tribes, where you kill the animal and you wear the skin of the animal. And then the Jata Mukuta, the long hair, and just different aspects that have got associated with him. Of course, the Keshan, the long hair, is there in the Rig Veda already, and he's associated with them as Rudra. But I guess somewhere we can see continuities, but in the image. But somewhere there's a definite break also. Yeah.
Are you going to bring up the Vratyas who appear under asceticism?
I wasn't going to, because I did write about them, but it took me so long. Atharva Ved talks about the Vratyas and the Vratyas Tom. And it's a very obscure, it's a whole book in the Atharva Ved. It's very obscure. I tried to read it and I just couldn't understand it. I'll have to take help from my friends who know better Sanskrit. They were also a kind of ascetic. And they seem to be wandering, militant kind of ascetics. Interestingly, again, I'm bringing up Sanderson again and again, but yesterday he was talking about how ascetics could become militant. And then just today I read about how these Vratyas were militants. And they could just, join a band of an army at any time. They were probably extremely strong, and because of their rigorous tapas, they had a lot of strength as well.
Asko writes about how there are links between the starting of some of the Vratya rituals and the propitiation of the goddess.
Asko Parpola?
Yeah.
Okay.
In that Vach article that I'm
Okay, talking. I need to read that, yeah. Okay. Thank you. So, are you ready to see the slides? Yeah.
Just a small question.
Yeah.
You said that this
which is not fashionable anymore. It's out. I'm sorry. I still like it. I still use it.
What is that?
I call it the Quranic process. It's in, yeah.
Are you the one who's established?
Well, I talk. I don't call it Puranic process, but another historian has, a person called Kunal Chakrabarty. But it's just this whole process of acculturation, assimilation, two different schools, two different sections. Now, I want to make it very clear, we all know it already, actually, that there's a mutual osmosis taking place. And where exactly is there a great tradition, and you know what we were talking about even at lunch, where is it a great tradition, when does it become a little tradition, how much are we taking from the so-called indigenous population, how much is there tribalization taking place, and how much of Brahmanization is taking place. That, of course, is always very difficult to determine. But when we're teaching this about this, I mean, we're teaching students about this whole process, it's difficult not to say that, yes, there was this hegemonic great tradition which was Brahmanical, which was Sanskritized, and then there was the little tradition, there was this constant give and take, two-way traffic working between the two of them. And earlier they used to just say the great tradition was changing the small traditions. But now, of course, we know that it was vice versa. In fact, there was much more changing going on here. I mean, Ganesh, for instance, the way he gets grafted on. I wish there was more time so I could talk about Ganesh, but just the way he was born. I mean, it's amazing how we can't... How obvious it is that he's born from neither children are born through sexual intercourse properly, and both of them, it's just because Shiva wasn't a single person, he was meant to be a different kind of deity. I mean, in a way, I must say the ingenuity of the mythographers, they want to justify something, but at the same time they don't want to go too far. They want us to be able to think and say, yes, Shiva and Parvati don't have two sons in a normal manner. Ganesh is born completely independent of Shiva through Parvati's scarf, through the unguents that she rubs on her body on the fourth day of her menstruation. So she's therefore Ganesh Chaturthi. And it goes back, it harkens back probably to a long time, millions of years ago, whenever, when people actually thought that women gave birth to children without any help from males. It's possible. Mothers in common, like Skanda Kartike, six mothers. All of them, the male doesn't have anything much to do with it. So it could go back to a period like that.
What I find amazing is today in India, you have Shivratri, where women are praying for the ideal husband.
Yeah, I was asked this at my PhD. Yeah, I was asked by Narendranath Bhattacharya. He specifically asked me this in my Viva. He said, when Shiva is always taking hash, and is into drunken brawls, and you know, has all these friends whom he prefers to spend time with rather than his wife and his family, etc. And why is it that you women every Monday fast for a husband like Shiva? So I was taken aback. Is this a question to ask in a Viva? So then I just said, well, I like interesting men. So and how did he know whether I fasted or not? I said, he's so colorful. Give me Shiva any day. Don't give me Ram. Maybe not even Vishnu. Shiva any day. The colorfulness, the vibrant nature of Shiva.
But where did he become the ideal husband? At what point?
You know, we should talk about this. I mean, why? Because women are the ones who are fasting. In my college, in Jesus and Mary College, I'm amazed at seeing how many girls fast on Monday. They're fainting in my class. What's happened? You're also fasting for Shiva. Ma'am, we're fasting today. We haven't even had water. Why? For Shiva kind of husband? Yes, ma'am. We want Shiva kind of husband. So it's just something, it's something in the psychological realm. We need to work on it. We need to know, why do women like men like husbands? Arya? Maybe you can answer that. You don't want the straightforward, you know. Nobody fasts for a husband like Ram. And yet, in every household, the daughter is told, be like Sita. That is what's so alarming. Be like Sita, cry all your life, go into the fire when need be, don't protest. No mother will say, why don't you behave like Parvati? Or why don't you behave like Durga? Because if you see Parvati and Shiva had a wonderful egalitarian relationship. And the two of them, very often, even in the murtis, you'll find they're discussing and talking with each other. So if he puts his hand around her shoulder or on her breast, she also tries to do the same in the murtis, and which is really very, very charming, that it's not just him who's being demonstrative towards her. She's also being demonstrative towards him. There's this very nice sculpture, which I wish I had it, which shows the tension between Shiva and Parvati. The two of them often play chess, and it's either a dice game or it's a kind of chess, and she is literally sitting there winning the game. And when she's winning the game, I talked about it when I spoke to all of you last time. She's winning the game, and one by one, she, Nara and all these people who are sitting and encouraging Shiva, they're saying, you know, you can't, she, don't let her win, don't let her win. And she's going on winning, and then finally they start telling her, you're cheating, you're a cheater. And you're cheating, you can't possibly win against Shiva because he's invincible. And finally she wins, and then she starts saying, as she was winning, she says, take off that crescent moon. So he takes off the crescent moon. She said, give it to me because I've won. She makes a hole, she puts it on as an earring. Then she says, take off the snakes. She wears them on herself as garlands. Then she finally says, take off that loincloth. And that's when he gets really angry. And it's there in the Purans. I'm not just saying it. I was giving a lecture in America, and they said, yes, strip poker. That's it. This is what we call strip poker. These, your gods and goddesses played strip poker. I said, yeah, is that how you play strip poker? I've never played strip poker before. But anyway, so she tells him to take off the loincloth, and then he says, what kind of wife are you? What will the people say? What will our worshippers say? You know, you made me take off my crescent moon, you made me take off my snakes, and now you want my loincloth? So then she retaliates. She said, what do you have to do? You went to Daruvan, to the pine wood forest, completely naked. You don't need clothes. You're the one who's already arrived. What do you need clothes for? So she's being sarcastic. This kind of constant tussle and conflict between the two of them. I mean, they discuss worldly matters. I believe they go for aquatic sports. They go riding on the bull. We hear about all this in the Purans, the two of them doing such nice husband-wife friendly kind of things together. And very often the things they do, then it erupts in conflict. There's one particular one in which they're playing chess. He's completely emaciated. You can see every bone of his, and he's sitting there and playing chess with Parvati. What does that indicate? What kind of what is the symbolism behind that? Why is Shiva being shown with all his ribcage there, and she's voluptuous and rounded and nice and looking happy with her game? It's like tension going on because she was, after all, Mahishasurmardhini. She was, after all, the goddess who destroyed Mahesha. And there's too much of similarity between Mahesh and Mahisha. There's a problem there. She's destroyed her husband, and she sticks out her tongue as Kali later on because she steps on him and she does all kinds of things with him. But perhaps there is something about her destroying her own husband.
I think there has been a lot of speculation.
Yes, a lot of speculation. Yes.
And the relationship between Durga and Mahishasura is a very interesting
It's
one.
Very interesting.
Hiltubhaitan has
written Yes, I know.
But there's also all these South Indian ceremonies where she's married off to Mahishasura.
That's right, yeah.
So there is a lot there, and I do personally believe that, and this is my personal belief, that the figure in Indus Valley is Mahishasura.
Okay.
I mean, that's...
the one, the Indus seal?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So not a bull?
Because it's a bull deity.
Yeah, bull,
it's a
okay.
buffalo. I mean, the connection between bull and buffalo is very, very kind of vague.
Yeah.
In
Kosambi, Didi Kosambi has said that that's the
it's
horns of
the
buffalo, not the bull.
The most important buffalo deity in the pre-Vedic context.
Yeah.
And I feel that the fact that it needs all the energies of all the gods to kill this deity.
Yes,
he must have been an
Shiva.
Awfully powerful person.
He must have been Shiva.
Yeah, I don't know about Shiva to be that late, I do think Mahishasura, after all, within the Iranian context, Asura, of course, was a deity.
It was a deity. Yeah.
So,
okay.
I mean, he was a terribly important god.
Yes.
Who had to be suppressed.
Yeah.
The killing...
the manner in which she kills him.
Well, it's the way that you have the suppression of certain cults. Iconographically, the way she is stepping on
his
him is an iconographic way of showing the suppression of another cult.
Okay. Yeah. So there was cultic tension between the two. Yeah. That's right. Yes. Are we ready? Do you want to switch off the light?
Is it on?
Okay. This is a... I think we're starting wrong, but doesn't matter. This is a Lakulish of an early period. All my sculptures are mainly from Madhya Pradesh, since I did most of my work there. Here, as you can see, he's not ithyphallic. We know Lakulish is the deity with the Lakula, that is the club which he's holding in his hand. And what is interesting here is that, of course, he has his four followers, which we know about, Purusha and Gargya, etc. And what is interesting is it looks so Buddha-like. It's almost like it's Buddha. I mean, maybe the ethi-phallicism has been destroyed recently. I can't really tell. But it's a more Buddha-like figure. And this is in Madhya Pradesh. We find almost 21. I went around counting how many sculptures we have of different deities. And we have like 21 Lakulishas in the period between circa 550 to 1200 CE. Very important deity. And the fact that he's holding a weapon, which is actually, you know, it shows the aggression of the deity, which means that perhaps at this time in areas of Madhya Pradesh, and I would think in Gujarat as well, there was a lot of rivalry between the different gods. And that's why it becomes necessary for them to show that. Okay. How do we do this? Okay, this is what is called the Bhikshatan Murti. As you can clearly see, I don't know if you can see from there, but Shiva is very much ithi-phallic. This is when he's come to the Daruvan forest and he's asking for alms. He says, give me alms, I'm the beggar. He's the ultimate mendicant. And so he's also celebrated as the Bhikshatan, that is the person who begs, the ultimate ascetic who begs. And this is again from Madhya Pradesh. Sorry. Okay, we need a little bit of focus here. Can you focus it a little from there? I don't know if it's can be done. Is it just
really
like
just
that?
Too dark.
It's
yeah.
too dark.
Okay. Really? Okay, this is actually Kapalika, but since we can't see it, so. Okay, this is the Bhikshatan Murti. This is how he's supposed to be shown, with a bit of a flabby stomach. And this is the Katwanga that he carries with him. It's interesting that all the Shaiva followers always have to have some form of either Laguda, Katwanga, some kind of Lati, some kind of stick with them. And he's also the god who is untouchable here, the bell here. This is the bell which all untouchables had to ring before they entered the village. And so he's impure as the Bhikshatan. And that's again a contradiction, because you're an ascetic and you're supposed to be pure, but because he's carrying that bell which he will ring as he enters the village, that shows his impure status. This is Vankeshwar. Now again, it's not written there, but I found an inscription very close to this place where this was found, which is in Bilaspur. Bilaspur was largely tribal for a very long time, and the period which I'm talking about, I found that there's this particular Kalachuri ruler who went into Bilaspur, and it seems, it's so obvious in his inscription that once he went there, he felt that he would be destroyed if he didn't worship the gods the people were worshipping. He had his own deities, but he started worshipping this Vankeshwar. And it's clearly stated that in this temple, where this image was found, in this temple, Shiva is not worshipped in his ling form, but in an image form, and his feet were being cleaned in, with water, etc. That's the kind of description that is given. Now, I know it's ithi-phallic, but I have not been able to understand why it has all these faces on its body. My nephew was very happy with this image. He says, look at all the smiley faces on the statue. And he found it very fascinating with all the mustaches and things like that. People have said maybe it's, it's a very unusual. Two, three people have tried to analyze it and nothing satisfactory. So if any of you have an idea as to what is going on here, he's a deity of the robbers, of the vagabonds. He goes, Banka, as we looked up, Daniela and I, you know, goes round and round in circles. He's a wanderer. And a form of Shiva which would have been very tribal, I suppose. This is the way Shiva is supposed to be depicted. Very slim-waisted, Sinhakati, sitting in what is called Ardha Paryanak. It's a yogic posture where you sit in a very relaxed manner with your leg like that. Again, you can see he's clearly ithi-phallic and beautifully made. This is actually from a place where I was born, that is Sagar, Madhya Pradesh. It belongs to the 6th century AD. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll just go fast. Yeah, here's the Lakulisha again. As you can clearly see, he's ithi-phallic, and his hairstyle, the curly hair and the long ears, Madhavanti, you must be knowing, it indicates royalty. Because you have such long earrings, or you wear heavy earrings, it also indicates wisdom, I suppose.
And it's
but
one of the signs of great people.
Great people, yeah.
Lakshmi.
That's right. So he's there, and again from Madhya Pradesh. Here we have a more realistic depiction of the ling. The laguda in one hand and a kind of citron fruit on the other. I find this quite unusual. Again, very much yogic posture. That's another thing that I forgot to mention, that yoga is so closely associated with Shiva and the whole thing of Dhanasism. Okay. This looks completely Buddhist to me. Again, it's 9th century and it's from Bilaspur. So it's a little surprising. I made that statement just a little while ago that Bilaspur was largely a tribal area for the longest time. There must have been some tension between Shaivites and Buddhists. We have vague references in inscriptions, because that is the reason why a deity who is supposed to be an incarnation, Lakulisha is supposed to be the 28th incarnation of Shiva, is being depicted completely like Buddha. So, you know, just like Vishnu appropriated Buddha as the 9th avatar of Vishnu, Buddha is supposed to, similarly, Shiva is trying to do the same. Yes.
What are the signs that
this is? We have inscriptional evidence. You're right, it doesn't have the laguda, but we have inscriptional evidence, so obviously we can't see it, but the people who labeled it, they may be wrong. Let's look at this. Okay, these are the Uma Maheshwar Murtis, the loving kind of the togetherness that I was talking about between Shiva and Parvati. This is the one I was talking about, her trying to put her hand over his shoulder. Why I like this sculpture is that she's obviously looking a little uncomfortable. He's so much taller than her, but she's trying, and the artist is trying to show that not only does he put his hand around, but she puts his hand around. I think it's a very beautiful one. It's called Uma Maheshwar Murti. Okay. This is the one in which they're playing the dice game, the one I was telling you about, and all the accompaniment around him. This is from the Chonsat Yogini Temple of Kheravan in Jabalpur. This is, of course, she's talking, she's listening to him. This is again from Bhairaghat. This is the two of them riding the bull, one of the activities that they used to take part in. And he's riding the bull and she's looking at herself in the mirror. And that's something tend to do. This is what is called Kalyan Sundar Murti when they're shown getting married. Interestingly, in Madhya Pradesh, I found a lot of them as a loving couple, the ones that I showed earlier. The ones in which they're depicting their marriage, which is called Parvati Parine or Kalyan Sundar Murti, are very few. It's almost like marriage was not that important. They're like five. If you go by the basis of cultural history, they're like five of these. But Uma Maheshwara had like 55 from Madhya Pradesh. So perhaps marriage, the marriage of the gods, was not such a popular depiction.
While in Chola bronzes,
that's an area probably which already saw statehood. And, you know, was not tribalized. That's, again, a Parvati Parana. Okay, this is Harihar. And one side is supposed to be the Jata Mukuta, and one side the Karan Mukuta, Kiritta Mukha, which Vishnu is supposed to wear. And this is what I find interesting, that such must be the rivalry and the conflict between two deities, that there was a necessity to merge them in one statue or one icon. So it's starting with Ardhanarishwar, where, you know, simultaneous worship will be, you can simultaneously worship the two. They tried it with Harihar. I don't think it appealed to the people much. Firstly, it was in a place which was non-tribal. It was in a place called Mandasore, which was very much already had a settled kind of existence. I don't think worshippers liked this much, because we don't, again, have more than three or four as compared to the other numbers. This is the Harihar Pitama Surya. Again, syncretic ideology, composite deities, attempt to bring four different deities together so simultaneous worship can be offered at one time. An indication, perhaps, I would like to think, an indication of some kind of cultic tension. This is, of course, Ardhanarishwar. There's a famous story about Ardhanarishwar, which is one of my favorite stories, which shows that there was so much of tension between the two. Shiva and Parvati standing together. Many of you may already know it. Pringi, the sage, Pringi coming. He's a pugnacious worshipper of only Shiva. And so he circumambulates only Shiva, which angers Parvati. She goes into the forest and does like 30,000 years penance, comes back to be joined with Shiva. Now, the ego problem is there. I want to be joined in Shiva's body so that this worshipper will circumambulate me as well. This is clearly written in the Purans. So she comes back as half his body. But when she comes back and Pringi comes back to worship, he goes back and does 30,000 years penance and becomes the beetle and pierces a hole between Shiva and Parvati and circumambulates only the right side of the body, which is Shiva's body. And then what does Parvati do? She says, I bow down to you because you're the greatest worshipper and you're such a great worshipper of only Shiva and no one else but Shiva. So definitely a close-minded worshipper. So the Ardhanarishwar was definitely, I mean, people have used it a lot, the whole idea of bisexuality, androgynous image. I just like to look at it as syncretic image. Perhaps at a particular point of time it was required. I don't have very romantic ideas about Ardhanarishwar. This is really very rare. You rarely find Ganesh as Ardhanarishwar. How would we call him? Ganesh, hermaphrodite image of Ganesh. The only thing I'd like to say is that Ganesh in the Purans is this kind of son who loves to imitate his father. So whatever his father is doing, the son is wanting to do. Again, psychologically, you can see that in one's own life. You know, so when he sees his father as Ardhanarishwar, he also tried to be Ardhanarishwar. Yeah. Again, from Madhya Pradesh. Is that all? Okay, here, this is the one, the ling I was talking about constantly. The very first one, it's a circa 2nd century BC. Those of you who are in my lecture with Sanderson, this is the one he was insisting was 7th century BC.